Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
Wednesday morning. Are we technically in spring? Have we crossed the threshold?
I don't think technically, but man, it feels... I was in Miami, so it was 85 and sunny, but I come back to DC, I land at Dulles, and I'm thinking, man, it's going to be nasty, and not too bad, man. 50s, sunny.
Yeah, you were in a bit of a... We were pretty warm in Western Mass, relatively speaking, last week, and now it's like 40s, which is good for mapling, good for tapping.
Sugar Shack season right around the corner.
No, we're in Sugar Shack season right now. If you're looking to get some hotcakes, you know, on the weekend, you know, the Sugar Shacks are open, so now's the time.
Have you been to Sugar Shack?
You know, my kids, if you do Sugar Shack right, you need to get there early because the line will really blow up, you know, by, you know, 9, 10 o'clock. You want to get there like, you know, 7:30 in the morning. And, you know, my kids are teen tween. Like, they're not getting out of bed on the weekend at that time anymore. So I haven't forced the issue. I might try to see if I can get one in before the season's done in early April, but I haven't yet.
I think we could do a viral video with you doing this with Def Leppard's Pour Some Sugar on Me as the background music. And then at the end, just a perfunctory you laying on the ground with someone literally pouring maple syrup on your face.
You know, there's a Pour Some Sugar on Me lyric in the new Beyonce.
Of course I knew that, Bill. I wrote my dissertation.
You don't have Texas Hold'em on a loop, Matt?
No, you know, this is her country album, right? I've not heard it.
Well, I mean, I think the full album's dropping in a week or so, but she put out two tracks a couple weeks ago, and they're good.
Is it good?
They're very good. I mean, there's no... obviously, art's a matter of opinion, but it's not like you're listening to it and feeling like she's straining to break into a genre that she has no business in. Like, they're just good songs. And they're not... like, they're not cookie-cutter country. Like, it's still very much a Beyonce track. But the fact that it's also country, like, it feels very natural and organic. And her banjo player is Rihanna Giddens, who's become more and more known. She was in the Carolina Chocolate Drops several years ago, which was also a fantastic black bluegrass band. And also an Oberlin graduate, Rihanna Giddens. And she's really become one of the leading voices recapturing the history of the banjo and how it really originates from African countries, at least in a proto form, and becomes more of what we know as a banjo through enslaved peoples. And was known as an instrument amongst slave populations. And it's from the racist minstrel shows that white people began to use it until they're like, oh, this is actually a good instrument. Let's do our own stuff on it. And now it's become more identified as this white, you know, rural instrument that's not the original origin. And so you're seeing something like, how dare Beyonce, you know, they're trying to take over everything now. And it's like, no, this is actually the origin of the instrument, you know, and she's bringing it back to its roots. So it really does close the circle of, you know, from a musicology standpoint, and it's just simply good songs.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Good music's good music, and if it's heartfelt and authentic, and she's from Texas, right?
So I think she's been trying to sort of, yeah, I mean, she did the Dixie. She performed with the Dixie Chicks, the Chicks at the CMA several years ago.
Wait, I'm offended, Bill. I'm offended by this. I call them the Dixie Ladies because I feel like Chicks is a pejorative.
So I think she's had an interest in trying to. I mean, I think she likes the genre. You know, she probably grew up with the genre in Texas, and so I think she's been inching that way, and now coming on strong.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I think the dobro is Hawaiian, right? Isn't that from Hawaii? So
I can't speak to that.
But it's just the amalgam, the music that we listen to, it evolves and it comes from different areas, and it's super cool. So thank you for reminding me. I need to check that out. Maybe we should turn though, Bill, from happiness and diversity and art to the darker world that you and I inhibit typically, which is that of politics. And Bill, there's a big controversy this week, and frankly, I'm surprised that we wouldn't even be still talking about it if it hadn't lingered for a lot longer than I think it deserves to. But this is something Donald Trump said at, I think it was a rally in Ohio this past weekend. Let me play the clip, but I think it's become something of a Rorschach test for different people. Different people are interpreting this differently. I will play the clip, and I want to get your take on the other side.
Every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it. But they're not going to sell those cars. They're building massive factories. A friend of mine, all he does is build car manufacturing plants. He's the biggest.
All right, so he used the term bloodbath, and I'm telling you, a lot of the media, in fact, the first reports I saw were basically Donald Trump threatening that if he loses an election, it's going to be a bloodbath. And my interpretation of that was riots in the streets and violence. And of course, there is context to that. This is the guy who incited the Capitol riot. But other people, Bill, feel like I was talking about cars and tariffs and trade and stuff. That's an expression that people use, like the Yankees. What a Yankees game last night. It was such a bloodbath. Where did you come down on this?
I'm mainly annoyed we're having the debate. I mean, there's a lot I want to say. We could go back to the
Dixie Chicks if you want to just stay there.
No, I don't want to. I mean, I think it's important because of what has transpired to delve into it. But I mean, the thing about that rally that was the most disturbing, although it wasn't quite new, was this whole hard embrace of the January 6th hostages, quote unquote. And perhaps that's not what made the news because he's done it before. But you literally have a presidential candidate who is promising to free people who have been imprisoned for an insurrection. I mean, that really should shake you to your core. And so when we talk about context, that's also part of the context here. Now, if I never knew anything about this guy in my entire life, and that's the only clip I ever saw of him, I would say, oh, yeah, he meant an economic bloodbath. He's not literally talking about blood in the streets. I mean, clearly he's talking about cars. You can say, and he said, that's going to be the least of it. I might still say, well, sure, maybe car prices are going to, the car industry is going to collapse, and there might be other economic consequences. That's what he means by that's not the least of it. But this is, of course, after he just created solidarity with insurrectionists and was a de facto leader of an insurrection, even if he didn't necessarily cross a legal threshold there, or at least that it hasn't been adjudicated. So you could interpret it different ways based on your perspective. And so my overarching point is if you're a Democrat or someone who doesn't want to see Trump get reelected, you don't want to be in this semantic, ditch. You don't want to have a debate over what did he mean all the time, because that's going to muddy the waters, chronically. And this goes back to what I've been harping about before, and you've very generously written about it in your own column.
I very generously borrow your ideas that you give every week. I can't quit doing this show because, free ideas that get stimulated here. But I think I did cite you and quote you in that one.
You need a narrative frame to create, ongoing context. You need a frame that allows the voter on his or her own to hang things on that frame without you having to spell it out for them. You're seeing in some of the early Biden advertising clips of Donald Trump being goofy or being disturbing or being deranged, which, you know, caricatures him in a, you know, in a help. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying these are like horrible things for them to do as messaging strategy, but I think it falls short of having the kind of framing that you can add this bloodbath episode to in a way that people intrinsically get what the broader import is. And that, to me, that frame is the way Trump talks in a hateful, divisive way on a daily basis when he was president led to a breakdown of society, led to rioting in the streets, led to insurrection. That is the end point of how he talks to the public. So it doesn't matter when that's your frame, it doesn't matter what he meant. The point is he's always doing things like this. He's always dancing around that line, whether he goes over it or he's just behind it. By doing that on a regular basis, ends up with Americans turning on each other and lighting the country on fire. That, to me, is what people's takeaway should be.
I agree. I think that's a nuanced take, but that's not what's happened. The media, a lot of the mainstream media, I think initially portrayed this without the context, without the nuance that you and I have provided here. And they have run with this for days and days and days. And I think that it's actually they're hurting the cause of stopping Trump and Trumpism, because what they're doing is they're providing an opportunity for a lot of people to say, look at what the media is doing. Obviously, he's talking about, you know, trade and auto, you know, tariffs or whatever. And the media is taking him out of context and they're saying that he is talking about physical violence. He's not. Everybody uses the term bloodbath. It's like we use martial language for better or worse all the time, particularly in politics, but really in everything. Like I said, you could say like, yeah, it was a real bloodbath last night in the Yankees game or whatever. And so I think this gives an opportunity for people to dismiss the media. Like maybe everything they're telling us is fake news, because here is a clip. Look, I'm watching it in context. They are misrepresenting it. They are overhyping it. And so I actually think this hurts the cause of those of us, because here's my thing. And I felt the same way a couple weeks ago. I don't know if you remember this, but at CPAC, there was an example where Donald Trump was on stage and he was talking about his wife, Melania. And then he said something about Mercedes, and he meant Mercedes Schlapp, who is the wife of Matt Schlapp, who runs CPAC. And a lot of people in the media, trusted mainstream media outlets, said that Donald Trump was confusing his own wife, that he thought her name was Mercedes instead of Melania. If you watch the full clip, that is not the case. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump was like, he talks weird, you know, it's discursive, but so we should not be engaging in propaganda and trying to make Trump look worse than he does. By the way, there's no need to. He says crazy stuff all the time. He says horrible things and confused, weird things all the time. If you want to make him look like he has cognitive issues, you do not have to invent them. If you want to make him look like he is summoning violence and using violent rhetoric, you do not have to pretend. You do not have to manufacture it. It is there.
I don't think the origin of these things are deliberate attempts to be dishonest. You have a group of people, I think Semaphore, Dave Wilder did a story about them, although I haven't read it yet. You have a group of people online who all they do is track Trump's speeches and pull out the clips, you know, in close to real time and push it out on social media channels. The ones that really take off can then bleed into mainstream media coverage because people are talking about it. And so on the liberal progressive influencer side of this ecosystem, they're just pulling clips without even like thinking about broader context. It's just these are snap decisions. And so if it looks like he got Melania's name wrong, you just push it out without stopping to think about it. You see bloodbath, that's a new word. He hasn't used that word before. Let's push that out. And then if some of these things catches on, then it becomes a cable news talking point. And what I think would frustrate some people on the left is they'll say, well, the media, they should be against fascism. They should they should be fighting fascism. That should be part of their charge. Well, yeah, they should be for freedom, of course. No one should be, saluting Nazis. But they also have, in a democracy, they have an obligation to cover presidential campaigns in a neutral way. And particularly on the cable TV side, their structure is to find points of debate. They need to fill 24 hours of content a day. And if they get something that says, someone says X and someone says Y, that's a segment. Great, I got a segment. I can fill up 10 minutes of time with this segment. If people we're going to debate, what does it mean by bloodbath? Oh, that's a segment. Boom. And I can copy that segment probably five times, six times in a day to fill up my 24 hours of time. They're looking, that's their business model. And you can't expect them to junk that just because you want them to take a harder line against the candidate that you don't like. So there's things that, a campaign like the Biden campaign can't control what the online influencers do, and they can't directly control what the cable news machine is going to do. But you can put out your own narrative. So when these things happen, people are more quick to discuss it within your framing because you're hitting it so consistently. And therefore, so you might have more indirect influence on what these people do because you're giving them your own context. And I think it's what's missing right now. I mean, I don't want to be a total bedwetter, be like, this means Biden's going to lose. I'm not taking that far. But as far as how do I think they could strengthen their position, I would be more, not just have a narrative, but a narrative that ends on, remember how the Trump presidency ended. Remember what it culminated in. Always go back to that because that makes it less detached from it makes it harder for Trump to retcon his own story and say, well, everything was awesome during my day, as you wrote about from 2017 to 2019. Yeah. You want to get everything back to 2020 as much as possible. I think that framing helps you do that.
Yeah. So for those who missed our well, first, let me quickly say, I think it is responsible of media people, individuals and institutions to when you see that clip pop up, the Twitter, short or whatever of Trump saying something, watch the video in context and then decide. And maybe it's not worth retweeting or maybe it deserves more context. And then maybe if you got it wrong, don't double down. So I do think that journalists in some cases are undermining their reputations by pushing this story as if he said, as if Trump clearly said bloodbath in a way that was a warning that if he lost, there'd be blood in the streets. That is the implication. It's not clear at all. Anyway, but what Bill has been referring to, I should say, is I wrote this column at the Daily Beast based off of conversations that Bill and I have been having for a few weeks about how it's really weird. Donald Trump has gotten away with gaslighting America into essentially believing that his administration went from 2017 to 2019. And he's basically saying it was the greatest economy in the world. It wasn't. But anything that happened during COVID doesn't count because that's a horrible thing that happened to me. And I had no control over it. So we should all pretend like 2020 didn't happen. And Bill, two quick thoughts. One is like great presidents rise to the occasion during tremendous moments of crises, right? That's why we elect people who have competence and character and integrity and experience, because it's not for a normal, random day. It's when crisis hits, and that's how you become great. That's how Lincoln and FDR and It's when you rise to the occasion. The other thing I would say is just from a more kind of mundane analogy would be a football game. I mean, imagine a quarterback who loses the Super Bowl and then says, yeah, but man, that doesn't really matter. The first three quarters, we were playing great. I was like, well, that's awesome, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is when the game ended, what was the point, you know, did you put points on the scoreboard? And there's a lot of good teams and a lot of good quarterbacks who do great in the first three quarters, and they are not winners. And they oftentimes do not get rewarded the way that MVPs might. So anyway, that's what we've been talking about.
One thing, but I also would add to this, you know, people romanticize the past very readily. So it sort of drives, I think, Democrats crazy. How do people forget so quickly all these horrible things that Donald Trump did? And if you can put yourself back in that time, you know, Trump was unpopular the entire presidency. So, yeah, the economy was actually in pretty good shape from 2017 to 2019, but he was still unpopular because he did all sorts of horrible things on a regular basis that people didn't like. Was being racist, coddling up to Russia, you know, separating migrant children from their parents. You know, all sorts of horrible stuff went down. And Trump is trying to make you forget that by just focusing on the economic side of it. And so it's not just saying 2020 was bad separate from 2017, 2019. The point I'm trying to make is everything Trump did led to 2020. The way he set the tone for the country led to the horrible things that his presidency ended upon, which is why it's very easy to say you should do this, you should do that. If you did things my way, then it would be awesome. You know, it's always easy to make these arguments in a vacuum, and you can't prove it unless you actually try it and see what happens. But this is why I think it would have saliency and resonance, because we did feel that way in 2017, 2018, 2019. We didn't like the way he was behaving. We know that the way he was divisive rankled our sense of decency in America. And that's the part that we have to try to come back and remember.
Right. And one of the things we talk about in the column, and that you and I have talked about, and I just talked to David French about it as well here on this YouTube channel, is how the crime rate in 2020 was very high, and people think it's still high. It's actually a 50-year low of violent crime, I think, in cities right now. Biden doesn't get the credit for that, but some of the crime rate, I don't think you can't blame Trump for all of it, but some of the violence, I think, was part of the environment that he created.
I mean, we're talking about broader crime rate. Look, most presidents don't have direct bearing on the national crime rate, but it is. Trump is trying to put forth a narrative, which is we're descending into madness because of Joe Biden, and the numbers don't back that up. And so I think pointing out that the numbers are going down is a reminder that, you know, the way Biden handles the country, whether you want to say that crime was Trump's fault before or not, that to me is sort of beside the point. The point in bringing up those statistics is it's not true that we are a less safe country today than 4 years ago. I mean, that's just factually untrue. And it's been a side point. You can't, yes, we're having a big migrant influx right now. There are some problems associated with that, which particularly having cities find shelter for people is straining municipal resources. That's a legitimate thing to talk about. But Trump is trying to say we're experiencing migrant crime. And look, you can obviously find the handful of bad, you know, anyone can commit a crime. You know, anyone in any demographic can potentially commit a crime. And statistics show that actually more native-born people commit crimes than migrants commit crimes. But you can obviously find, you know, the horrible murder that happened in Georgia, for example, and magnify that to create a false narrative that this influx is happening and now we're all dying in the streets. You know, that's the connection that Trump is making, which is not factually backed up. And putting out the correct statistics helps push back on that narrative.
All right. Well, let's move to Ohio, where Donald Trump's endorsed candidate, Bernie Moreno, won pretty handily. Interestingly, early on in the night, it looked like it might be a nail biter, but Bernie Moreno, he's an immigrant, he's a car dealer, and he is endorsed by Trump. Trump went to the state, I think this past weekend, to stump for him. He easily won the nomination over a couple of other candidates. I think one was a Green Beret and one was part of the family that owns the Cleveland Guardians. Moreno will now face Sherrod Brown for the U.S. Senate in Ohio. I feel like it's probably Bernie's race to lose, but because Ohio is so Republican. And as everyone probably knows, Republicans are, I think, poised to take the Senate. They're going to obviously win in West Virginia, where Joe Manchin's retiring. They're going to possibly pick up Montana. They're going to possibly pick up Ohio. What do you make of all this, Bill?
Well, so far, now, number one, Moreno was, relatively speaking, the most Trumpy of the lot, the one Trump endorsed. There's some suggestion that perhaps he's not really Trumpy, but he's faking it to get Trump's endorsement.
In fairness, they all faked it. Every single one of them, even the one that Trump said was Mitt Romney, was a Trump pretender, at least.
Right. And I think it's only relevant in that we don't know how Trumpy he will be in the general. Does he have the capacity to pivot and sound more reasonable, because deep down he's not, you know, totally deluded.
Since you raised that, let me just put a pin in this. I've got a couple clips of him, but let me just play one, because I think, Bill, it speaks to this point you're making. I had never heard Bernie Moreno until this morning. I'd never seen him. I pictured someone who was going to be gruff and very, you know, rough around the edges, and that's not what I saw. Let me play the clip and see what you think.
July 4th of 2026, we're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the greatest nation on the face of the earth. And when we have that celebration, we're going to talk about how freedom and liberty's back, government's off our back, and I'm going to end where I started. What is this party all about? People say, I've lived the American dream. Started a tiny little car dealership with nothing. Say, that's not really, in my mind, what I view as the American dream. Where's my father-in-law? I'm going to pick on him again today. Where is he? Dennis, where are you? You're tall. There's my father-in-law right over there, Bridget's dad. All right? Dennis went to high school in Hobart, Indiana. He was born in Gary, Indiana. Graduated from high school, reported to work at U.S. Steel. By the way, did you notice the name of the company? U.S. Steel? Because it's going to stay U.S. owned. All right? Goes to work there, was able to buy a home, buy a car, raise three kids, send them to good schools and safe communities, and he's able now to retire debt-free. That's the American dream. That's what's under assault, and that's what we're going to get back.
All right. So that's what he's like. Too Trumpy. Not Trumpy enough with the Goldilocks Trump.
Okay, I'm not talking to you as a Bernie Moreno expert, so I can't know how this whole campaign's gonna go. But like, just seeing that clip, like that seemed like a solid candidate, you know?
Yeah.
I kind of believe, like, you know, when I think of who are the least liked people in America, I think car dealers are probably on the list of least liked people. But he didn't have a particularly smarmy car dealer vibe there, so perhaps he can, you know, be a good candidate now. As you may know, Matt, there was this controversy that cropped up right before the primary, where the Associated Press wrote an article that strongly implied that he was trying to hook up with quote-unquote young men through the website Adult Friend Finder. There was an account that used his email address. He tried to pawn off as a prank that one of his employees did, which sort of strains credulity. That's a weird thing for an underling to do.
Wait a second. It may be a strange thing for an underling to do, but I will say this. And you know, places I've worked, some of the play. Like I worked at the Daily Caller for 6 years, but I've worked other places too around a lot of young guys. Everyone had to do this before you would leave. You would have like your computer set to, after you walked away for 2 seconds, it would, lock, and you would have to type in like the password protection or whatever. Right. Why? Because people would come in and send out like blast emails from your account. People would text or email other people like in the office, maybe even other guy, like a guy like, hey, like some of these people that we've worked around are Neanderthals. And I don't know, they were looking to practical jokes or whatever. So like, I don't know, maybe this is legit, but it doesn't actually strain credulity for me to imagine like a guy in a car dealer in Ohio, like that someone would sign you. Like, think of this as a ultimate practical joke. If you're a conservative sort of white ethnic guy, I don't know, in like Cleveland or something in the 1990s, and you work at a car dealership, pretty good practical joke to sign one of your colleagues up for a gay tryst. I mean, would I do that? No. Do I condone it? Absolutely not. Could I imagine it happening in a place that I've worked? Yes, absolutely.
I think the more likely explanation is that he is gay and had an account where he's trying to hook up with young men. Now, again, it was young men, it was young boys. I'm not saying anything illegal. I'm not saying his personal life should have any bearing on whether he becomes a public office or not. And he used to support equal rights policies for lesbian, gay, bisexual people, maybe transgender people. I think you might have used LGBT in some past discussion. Forgive me if I haven't done my full research before talking to you. But he pivoted at all that now that he's been running for office. So I think there's a hypocrisy angle that's very legit here. Now Sherrod Brown at Democrats, they've not gone near this thing. So I don't know if it's become an issue, but it might. If I'm a Republican, I might be like, is there something else out here that I need to be worried about? Is something else going to crop up here? Was he fully vetted? I don't know. That's lingering out there, number one.
And I wonder, but I want to put a quick pin in that, Bill, because I do also wonder, like, in this political environment, let's say that there was, more evidence that it was true. Like, would that even hurt him anymore? Like, he could just keep denying it. And if there's nothing illegal, let's say, that he did, so there's no other shoe to drop. It's just, if a rational person would conclude that he was quote unquote guilty of doing this, would that even matter
in this environment? I mean, in theory, it might not. And it may be that the Sherrod Brown people are like, you know what, this really isn't the best avenue of attack here anyway. So it might all be completely irrelevant to the end of the day. But I have to imagine some Republicans are a little worried about, they don't know what else might be out there, because this came very late. And you never know if there's more shoes to drop. Another thing I want to mention, because you mentioned that you think Bernie's got the edge here, and it's not unreasonable to say. Ohio is definitely a red state, not a purple state these days. Wasn't always the case, but it has been the last 10 years or so. We do have a smattering of polling, Brown versus Moreno, actually three polls in March alone. Brown leads in all of them by an average of 5 points. Now, Brown is still below 50 in all those polls. So he was clocking it at 39, 43, and 45 in those polls. You might say, well, he's got the name ID and Moreno doesn't. And so now that he's the nominee, maybe that's going to start evening out now, or Moreno will be ahead. So I'm not saying this means, sure, Brown can rest easy. Obviously, this is going to be a dogfight. But Brown is someone that has, street cred in Ohio. Ohio was pretty red 6 years ago and Brown still won. So I think Brown does know the lay of the land, is always very careful to pick his spots to show he's not completely parcel of the Democratic Party. and has always maintained that I'm a friend of the working man vibe. Can he maintain that versus Mr. Car Dealership over here?
No, I think you're right about the vibe is so important. And I think that's what Manchin had in West Virginia. I think Tester has it in Montana, and Sherrod Brown with the gravelly voice and the, you know, just the vibe. He feels like a real kind of working class blue collar guy. And he has gotten elected multiple times. In fact, I think there's a line. Well, let me play this other Bernie Marino clip, and then I'll talk on the other end.
First got to South Florida when I was a kid. I was 5 years old. I thought it was a field trip. I didn't know what we were doing. And I wanted to become a U.S. citizen really badly. That was something that was really important to me. Even though I thought it was kind of cool that I had a card that said I was an alien, I thought maybe I wanted to be a citizen. That would be better. And as you may have heard this story, I studied our founders and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitutional Convention. And it's amazing because in 1789, when Sherrod Brown went into D.C., I never thought we'd be here with him still in office. But, you know, in all seriousness, so think about it. This guy's been in office since Richard Nixon was president.
So now some of Sherrod Brown's recent opponents, Josh Mandel and Jim Renacci, are not perceived as being great Republican opponents. So that's an asterisk. And then the other thing is, I can't remember the guy's name, Bill, who was the very good candidate, populist Dem, who lost to J.D. Vance.
Tim Ryan.
You remember who I'm talking about?
Tim Ryan.
That's it. Right. So Tim Ryan. So we have him. I know Tim Ryan's not Sherrod Brown, but Tim Ryan, I thought, ran a really good campaign in Ohio and had that same vibe or a very similar vibe that Sherrod Brown has. And obviously it didn't work last cycle against J.D. Vance, for what that's worth.
I mean, the only difference is that Sherrod Brown has won statewide before, and Tim Ryan hadn't. You know, Sherrod Brown has more of a track record here. If Sherrod Brown lost because Ohio is just a flat-out red state and Marino ran a good paint-by-numbers campaign, I would not be shocked. But it still is premature to say Marino has the edge until I think we see a poll actually shows him having the edge.
All right. Well, we'll be covering the Senate, I'm sure, because I think it's hard to fathom Republicans do not take back the Senate simply because, well, not right now. I think it's 51-49.
Wait, I mean, so give up West Virginia.
So well, now it's 50-50. Now well, it's 50-50. No.
Well, you know, there's a little bit of talk out there that, you know, Schumer's leaning on Manchin to jump back in the race and run as an independent. And Manchin's like, well, let's see what happens in the primaries. So, hey, maybe Manchin gets back in there and makes it a race. Who knows? But
the only way Manchin does that would be as if Mooney were to beat Governor Jim Justice in the primary. And then Manchin might get back in. I don't think.
Yeah, I don't know what he's waiting to see, if anything. But in all likelihood, Justice is that nominee. Maybe he hates Justice so much that he want to jump back in. I don't know. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, Republicans take West Virginia. Now you're at 50-50.
Yeah.
Now Democrats have to really run the table, which means either they're holding Ohio and Montana, Sherrod Brown and John Tester winning. They're keeping their seats. Or somehow... And mind you, there's also Arizona. You know, Gallego's got to beat Lake,
which it looks like he's doing. But they're playing defense. That's a blue seat that they have to hold.
But a blue seat in a reddish state that they're trying to hold on to. And I think Nevada's up. If I remember correctly, I think Jackie Rosen is up in Nevada. And that could be,
I think so, but that one's probably.
So they got to hold that seat too. Okay. I think those are the Democratic held seats that are most on the line. So they'd have to hold all of those. Now they're the reach pickup opportunities for Democrats. Could they possibly flip Texas or Florida? Again, I wouldn't bank on either one happening. But, you know, Ted Cruz has been a relatively weak statewide candidate before, almost lost to Beto O'Rourke 6 years ago. Rick Scott, always eludes me as someone who has gotten as far as he has. I think he's a weird candidate.
Well, he was the richest member of Congress.
Right.
So that helps.
Right. But he's got that weird Skeletor head. I don't think he's very charismatic. He's, again, what's worse than car dealership? I think health insurance CEO, I think is worse than car dealership CEO as far as people Americans respect and like. And then the Cruz's opponent, Colin Allred, is a first-rate candidate. Was the Florida Senate primary last night? I haven't done my job and haven't.
Bill, everyone knows that you're supposed to be the one who knows stuff.
Their primaries are late. They separate their presidential and their Senate primaries. It's August. They don't do their primary until August. I think it's a former congresswoman. Yeah, Debbie Musgrove Powell is the one. I think there is hope gets that nomination. It's not a done deal, but probably seems likely. Could she give Rick Scott a run for his money? Is there any kind of backlash in Florida after Ron DeSantis swung the state so far hard to the right? Does abortion become a bigger issue in Florida in 2024? Again, I'm not saying that any of these things are, you know, things for Democrats to be optimistic about. But it's not completely ludicrous that maybe weird things can happen. Upper Midwest, West is getting redder, but Sun Belt's still getting bluer, and therefore Democrats pull off an upset and offset a loss somewhere else. So those are the only two ways that they're going to keep set at this point.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on that. Bill, anything else you want to talk about or call it a day?
I think we can call it a day, Matt.
Okay. I think it's a good show. I think I'm tentatively calling this Bloodbath in Ohio. We covered two topics, but very extensively, I must say. Maybe three if you count the U.S. Senate as an extension.
And your clip work, Matt, has become, you know, it's elegant.
Thank you. It's a game changer. It really is. The ability to play those clips. Because first of all, otherwise you have to describe things and it's hard to get things just right. And maybe not, you don't intentionally. This way we can just play it and then comment on it. And it's good for the listener and the viewer.
It requires prep work, Matt. It's like you're doing work for this now.
A little bit. I'm trying to up my game. So people could reward us by, you know, going to the YouTube page, subscribe, liking what we do, telling a friend, going to our audio podcast, rating, reviewing, DMZ, the DMZ show. Or you could go to patreon.com/Matt Lewis or patreon.com/Bill Scherer. If you like what you're getting here and you like that we've upped our game, then maybe wet our beaks a little bit.
All right. Till next week.
All right. Always a pleasure. Also, follow us on Twitter @TheDMZShow. We'll see you back here on the DMZ next week.
Take care.
See ya.